NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
The Flight Safety Detectives is bringing on a new sponsor, Piston Powered, a power-by-the-hour program for owners of piston-powered aircraft that can stabilize the long-term cost of owning your airplane.
Well, hello, Todd.
Hello there, John.
Here's another episode of Flight Safety Detectives, and today we're going to take a little different tact by looking at accidents as they develop, not waiting for the NTSB to come up with their report. Talk about any updates that they give. Talk in general about an accident, a recent accident that's happened, and let's follow it through its paces. But before we start, I need to remind everybody that today's episode's being brought to you by our two sponsors. One, Avemco Insurance, an insurance company specializing in general aviation insurance, and by Piston Power, another company in the general aviation environment that talks about providing warranties for your engine, your accessories, or your entire airplane. And we will have more to say about them at future websites, future podcasts, just that they have decided to sponsor the program. So today, Todd, we have this helicopter crash in Texas that hit a tower. And as things start to unfold, I know you've been doing a lot of work on this. As things start to unfold, it starts to paint a picture that was a little different than we had in the very beginning. So why don't you share with us what you've learned?
Well, certainly. This was an event that took place on October 20th, 2024, where a Robinson 44 helicopter, which was an air tour helicopter with a pilot and three passengers on board, took off from Ellington Field, which is southeast of Houston, flying directly toward downtown. And about 9 minutes after takeoff, the helicopter struck a roughly 1,000-foot tall radio tower and collapsed the tower, and the helicopter was destroyed, and unfortunately, everyone on board, including a 9-year-old child, was killed. There was some dramatic footage taken at the time of the event that shows the helicopter actually striking the tower, and if you're watching the video version of that, we have some snippets of that there. And surprisingly, short time after the event was the preliminary report, which came out early part of November, which basically said a few things in addition to this, which was interesting. One of them was that the radio tower had three levels of lights on board. One level was above the height of the helicopter at impact. By the way, the helicopter impacted about 900 feet above sea level, and the tower was roughly 1,000 feet. There was a set of lights at about the 600-foot level and a set of lights at about the 230-foot level. There was also in that same report a security cam picture that showed both the accident helicopter shortly before impact and the lights on the tower. And it looked like the lights on the tower, the middle and the top lights, at least from the direction the camera was pointing, were working. Well, once we got the preliminary report, it mentioned in the first page that there was a second helicopter that where the air traffic controllers had issued a traffic advisory. And in the document here says, for a company tour helicopter, and it gave the tail number. I thought it was a kind of a strange way to word it. I did a little research, and it turns out that the helicopter that they were giving the traffic advisory for was a helicopter from the same tour company. In fact, that helicopter was featured on the website of this tour company, which, since the accident has taken that place, that website is no longer available. But looking at some of the archival sites, such as archive.org, we can see both that helicopter. We can see there are various packages offered by this company for touring around Houston. The event happened at night. It was a VMC, a visual meteorological conditions, visibility about 10 miles, light winds out of the southeast, nothing out of the ordinary. There is nothing about the weather that would have made this a challenging flight. However, getting back to that traffic advisory, shortly before impact, the pilot was reading back the traffic advisory and the transmission stopped suddenly, implying that whatever was told to the pilot by air traffic control was being read back by the pilot in the seconds before impacting this tower. Now, getting back to that first helicopter, I thought, why are they mentioning this? So what I did fairly simply was go to flightaware.com and I looked at the flight tracks of the two helicopters, the accident helicopter and the helicopter that was mentioned in the traffic advisory. And I did a very crude bit of geometry here. I drew a line from the path of the accident helicopter, which had been flying essentially at the same heading for at least a couple of miles before impact, extended that line to the point in the same minute of the impact where the other helicopter was. And it turns out that there was almost a straight line straight down the center of a vision, if you're looking up in the cockpit, that would have been right at where this helicopter was flying. And of course, if there was a traffic advisory and the accident pilot did say that they had the helicopter in sight, it would appear that in the last few seconds of flight, that the helicopter that was in the distance was lined up roughly with the tower lights. They were also roughly flying at the same heights. The only information we have is from ADS-B data, so we don't know if there is a flight data recorder on either helicopter, but it's certain that the accident helicopter struck the radio tower at roughly the 900-foot level. The other helicopter was also, again, roughly at the same altitude. Although I'm not going to say this was a cause of it, a distraction of the pilot, the preliminary data certainly does point in that direction.
It certainly would be at least situational awareness as well as distraction. Right. And those two helicopters did not take off from the same airport. Is that correct?
That's correct. The accident helicopter took off from Ellington Field, and the other helicopter took off from an airport on the other side of Houston, roughly the same distance from downtown as Ellington Field, and was heading back toward its takeoff point when the event occurred. And by the way, the second helicopter was not facing toward the accident helicopter, so it would have been difficult for the second helicopter to have seen the accident helicopter, but quite easy for the accident helicopter to see the second helicopter. They were both R-44s, by the way.
Okay, I didn't see anything in there yet indicating the age of the helicopters. So if they were older ones, they most likely don't have anything in the form of
Well,
re
I did look up the FAA registry for both, and the accident helicopter was manufactured in 2002, and the second helicopter was manufactured in 2004.
Right, so that they're old enough not to come under or have the option of having recorders put on.
And
So
they were
small,
both piston powered as well.
right? So it's probably likely that there are no recorders, which means the NTSB is going to have to work harder to figure out some of the basic information. That's
Well,
unfortunate.
from they do have a lot of help here in the sense that this happened in Houston, and there were several cameras the day of that actually recorded the impact of the helicopter. And I went online to YouTube and found two different views of the impact of that helicopter on the tower. And of course, in the preliminary report, the NTSB also had access to at least one security camera. So the recreating the flight path of this helicopter, the accident helicopter, might not be that difficult. What might be more difficult is recreating what went on before this event happened. That is, what kind of status the pilot had, whether or not there was any medical issues, that sort of thing. And the preliminary report doesn't have any of the background information like the coroner's report or or that sort of thing. But it does have enough to give a suggestion that this was clearly something that was not out of the ordinary. That is, there was nothing happening here that seemed to be dangerous or unusual. It was not a bad weather day. The helicopter, from what little information that was given, wasn't overloaded. This was something that this company, looking at their website, had done fairly frequently over several areas of Houston for quite some time. So the company as a whole probably had a lot of experience doing this. We don't have much information about the accident pilot. They do have a little bit of information about the radio tower. There was a NOTAM issued for the radio tower, but according to the radio tower owner, this NOTAM was issued due to a change of ownership, not due to any outages with the beacons or any problems with the tower.
And looking at the pictures, it looks like it was a pretty lonely tower out there that doesn't appear to be any close by.
And that's correct. This was, although it was fairly close to downtown, this was in a field. It was surrounded by buildings, apartment buildings, and whatnot, but there was a clear area around where the tower was. And although the tower did topple, there were some vehicles and damage in the area. No one else was hurt other than the four people who were killed in the helicopter.
Well, it's certainly going to challenge the NTSB to come up with a meaningful probable cause. It's another example of the lack of recorders on an airplane hindering in a big way safety improvements that could be garnered from an accident. So the last thing you want to do is have an accident and loss of life and have it go without improving the situation for others. And we do have those, and this may be one of them, where you just can't come up with a definitive cause. Situational awareness is a lot of fuzzy example. Distraction is another fuzzy example. I mean, those occur routinely in life. So how do you build a safety program on recommendations that may come to that? Now, this is we don't know where the recommendations are going to come until they dig into the history of the airplane, history of the pilots, and hopefully any other information they can get, like those videos. So it may take a positive turn, but right now it looks like it's going to be one of those accidents where we don't have a definitive cause. So we just say what we think might be reasonable, but not the most accurate.
Now, looking at this from a somewhat broader perspective, the entire industry of air tour operators, which operate all over the country, and again, this is something that's fun to do. Take a quick helicopter ride, see the sights, and land again. Personally, I was just overseas in Brazil near a famous waterfall in Brazil, and there was a helicopter operator operating jet Rangers that were operating tours of the area. I thought to myself, it'd be great to see these waterfalls, pretty outstanding waterfalls from the air. But sort of like what we were talking about the other day about taking a ride in the Warbird. Yes, it's always fun to fly. I don't mind flying. I love flying. But how do I feel about, on a whim, taking a ride in a helicopter with an operator might be quite respected, might have a large fleet, might have very experienced pilots. But the type of flying that's done in an air tour is not the type of flying that's done in an airliner. For example, you're going from point A to point B. Airliners have much more planning involved in this. They typically have to do an IFR flight plan, even though they might be flying VFR most of the time. But air tour operators, like the case here, in most cases, if you have poor weather that's IFR or close to IFR, they're not even going to be flying. So they're flying in fairly good weather. In this case, they're flying in the Houston area. Houston is a place that has multiple large airports. And if you look at the graphic of the flight path of this helicopter, you have Houston Hobby Airport to the south. You have Houston Intercontinental, George H.W. Bush Airport to the north. You have Ellington Field down near NASA in Clear Lake City. And you have a variety of smaller general aviation airports north, south, east, and west of Houston. So the typical day of flying, especially night flying in Houston, it could be multiple aircraft in the air. Now, as an air tour operator operating at a fairly low altitude, they're not going to be in the way of the airliners that are flying above them, but general aviation aircraft And in this case, other air-tour aircraft could certainly be in the same areas that they were flying, near downtown, near the major landmarks of Houston, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you raised some good points there. You know, and the air tour operators have had a number of accidents over the years. I did several of them when I was with the NTSB. And despite the best efforts of the tour operators, the Helicopter Association, and many others, it's still a challenging flying environment, and it's still risky, and there are still accidents because the helicopter pilots, more so than the companies, want to give the passengers their money's worth, want to give them good views of whatever landmark they're trying to see, and sometimes they get themselves in trouble by getting too close. I mean, I recall I did a helicopter tour in the Grand Canyon many years ago, and the helicopter pilot took us over to where the Indians had been living in caves on the side of a cliff, and he was bringing the helicopter in close, and I never looked at the dwellings that were carved into the side of the hill, because I was totally focused on his rotor blades and how close he was to the side of that cliff. So, I mean, and he was trying to give everybody a good, memorable ride. In my mind, I was looking at, you know, those helicopter blades, those rotor blades coming awfully close to the side of that cliff.
And
that would not have been good.
Now that you mentioned, there was another thing that concerned me about this. I was looking at the VFR chart for that area, and very clearly, there were several radio towers, including the one that was hit, that were clearly marked on the chart and clearly marked as being 1,000 feet tall. And my thought was, if I'm a helicopter pilot flying VFR at night in that vicinity of Houston, at the very least, I want to make sure that I'm above the altitude of any radio tower I'm coming close to, and would choose a path that would take me away from those towers. Again, what level of distraction was happening with the pilot? It's unclear. But looking at the ADS-B track, it was clear that this aircraft was flying absolutely, not absolutely, but pretty much on the same heading for the last couple of miles, which would have taken a minute or so given the speed of that aircraft. So if there was distraction, was there distraction before when it came to what altitude the airplane, helicopter should be at? Are there restrictions for air tour operators in the Houston area that keep them below the level of these radio towers? Or is this something that is a choice by the operator or the pilot, what altitude to fly?
I was looking at the direction from Houston Intercontinental Airport, the runway directions, and he wasn't in them at that moment. But as he proceeds forward in the direction that he was going, he would certainly be passing under the traffic coming out of Houston. I did not do that for Hobby to see what's going on with Hobby. It is clear looking at his track that he was skirting away from Bush Airport into, you know, IAH. He was keeping away from it.
Now, yes. I didn't do one piece of homework. Houston, I believe, has Class B airspace. So one question I should have, should answer is, was the aircraft in Class B airspace at that time? And if it was in Class B airspace, which is some of the busiest airspace in the country, there are certain specific requirements the aircraft must have in order to enter there. And being under positive control of air traffic control is one of them. But again, as you can see from this overall map, Houston Intercontinental and Hobby are quite a few miles away from downtown Houston. For those of you watching the video version of this, I'm going to have a little graphic up there that shows Class B airspace and where the accident helicopter was relative to that.
You know, in the sectional, it shows three towers, but in the picture, it only shows one, the physical picture that was taken at night.
But which gets into an entirely different question. Your aeronautical charts that you're using, how current are they? The entity that puts the charts together has to rely on information from other places. For example, is a building going up? Is there an antenna being put on top of a building? Is a new radio tower going up or coming down again? And it may take some time for that to bubble into the chart. There could be something in a notam saying that there's a temporary crane near this airport, that sort of thing. And it's up to the pilot in command every time they fly to check and see if there's any change in the notams, whether you have a navigational aid that's no longer valid for that time, whether there's going to be a runway close, whether there's a new obstruction, that sort of thing. So part of the investigation, I hope, of the NTSB will be looking at what was the process by which this company informed the pilots of what was going on in the areas where they're flying. What was the process by which they determined what routes they would fly on the various package deals they had on their website, and whether or not there was any oversight on the management side to make sure that those routes were updated to deal with new and evolving risk.
Yeah, I just happened to look at the number of people that the NTSB had. So they assigned one of the NTSB staff as the investigator in charge, who has been an investigator for a while, but he's got two other people from industry on his team. So that's going to put quite a burden on the NTSB investigator to gather all the information he needs and make sense out of it without having any interference.
And to no surprise at all, there's already at least one set of lawsuits out against the estate of the pilot, the accident pilot, the helicopter operator, and I believe even the radio the company owning the radio tower. So this is a legal issue that's going on one hand, and the air safety investigation part going on the other. And those two are separate. That is information, and John, you can speak to this. Information from the NTSB investigation is limited with respect to what a lawyer can get to or what will be released to the public. And even if there is a decision in the NTSB investigation that the fault was with this person or this entity, that doesn't cut it much when it comes to the legal process. That is, if someone's going to have a lawsuit, these things will have to be proved all over again.
Well, one of the ways that the attorneys have an edge is they file suit right away, normal. So, like Jimmy Buffett said, sharks to the left, sharks to the right. I mean, they're all around every accident. But what they end up with is they watch the NTSB and what they do very keenly, because it's no secret who the investigators are. When I worked in Washington, the Washington reporters on big accidents would have somebody outside the NTSB offices, so they know who the experts are. So if suddenly, the fire expert's going to Florida right after we have a big crash, and we did, they know we're looking at a fire. This fire is strongly suspected. So then they'll go find some experts that'll talk on the air about what about fire in the air? So they can generate a lot of news out of just watching who's traveling from the NTSB and where they're going. The NTSB has very few secrets, very few secrets, and they shouldn't have very many secrets. It should be public knowledge. It should be information that we get to people. I used to give speeches where I would say that in the case of an accident, you have a moment in time, and it might be 30 days, it might be a little more, where you have the attention of the industry, of the airline industry. You have the vast majority of people focused on it. And if you can come up with some good safety information in those that window of time, it's going to get to the maximum number of people, and it's going to have the maximum input, maybe even change their behavior. But if you dilly-dally, and it used to be we wanted to get all the NTSB reports done in one calendar year, and even that was long. After a year after an accident, all the interest has died down. Today, it's 2 years after the accident before many reports come out. That's ancient history. And it just doesn't have the power that it has when it comes out in the beginning. So I long advocated inside the NTSB when I was there that we really need to focus heavily in the very beginning and get as much as we can out of information out of that accident, including indications of the cause, not really naming the probable cause, just strong indications that we can put out in the industry because they're thirsty for the information and it's likely to drive change. And I failed. I didn't get it through. I pushed a few of them myself, or I did it on my own and releasing information to the press to put out. And usually it was the more specialized press, like Aviation Weekly or some of those others, where it could be focused on the aviation community, AOPA. There was a number of them that we used to get information out there as quickly as we could. I mean, it can't wait through years to put a safety report out. It's already old news by that point, and you just don't get the enthusiasm from the industry to make some changes around it.
And the enthusiasm factors into the average person out there. But personally, even though I'm in aviation safety and follow accidents fairly closely, off the top of my head, the only two air tour accidents that come to mind happened in New York. There was one that was a helicopter had a mid-air collision with a fixed-wing aircraft near the Statue of Liberty. There was another one, I believe, in the East River where they had a helicopter that had like open doors. And the passengers strapped in looking outwards. They had some sort of issue and they ditched the aircraft, and I believe there were fatalities there. Because it's in New York City, because it's the center of media for the United States and much of the English-speaking world, those two got coverage. This one in Houston, certainly it was a local story. There were plenty of local stories when it happened. And it's the kind of thing where I don't think it will have that same sort of long-term interest in the public, simply because we're talking about older helicopters. We're talking about not the highest technology helicopters that air tour operators could be using. And there was nothing else about this that is causing a lot of attention outside of aviation circles and outside the local area of Houston. But that said, there's still things that could be insightful. And this is my second to last word here. Even though we have only a preliminary report here, because of the media situation we have in this country and across the world, not just news media, but all sorts of media, people with mobile phones, security cameras, etc. There is a lot of information that comes out fairly quickly about this sort of thing. Even today, when I was doing research for this, I was looking up, well, are these two helicopters related in any way? I had to go to an archival site for the website of the tour company, which they took down since the accident, to find that one of the promotional pictures on the website was of the second helicopter. So even though it was not explicitly mentioned in the report, the preliminary report, already I'm thinking, well, is there something about the fact that this was a helicopter that was being noted by air traffic control that might have distracted the accident pilot even more? I don't know if it did. I don't know if it didn't. Certainly, I'll be looking at the final report to see if that kind of question was actually addressed.
Yeah, it's early yet, but and we will continue to follow this, but it's proven to be quite interesting so far. And I hope we do get to the bottom of it and hope we can make some positive changes. Well, Todd, it brings us to the second last word.
Well, I have my second to last word already. The floor is yours for the last word.
Well, in the last word, as I always say, far too many accidents happen because pilots don't follow what I'm about to say. So if you're going to go flying, you need to pre-plan your flight. You need to do it twice. Do it before you get to the airport. Do it again at the airport. And if they don't agree, find out why. Always make sure you check the weather, where you are, where you're going, and what's going on in between. Right, look for the trends. Look for the afternoon weather if you're leaving in the morning. Right, follow up on the weather. When you get out to your airplane, pre-flight, pre-flight, pre-flight. If you don't know how to do a good pre-flight, or if you're not sure, get a mechanic that works on the airplane and ask them to walk around the airplane with you. Ask them to open up panels and ask them what you should be looking at. Touch your airplane. Wiggle your flight controls. In last month's AOPA magazine, there's a story in there about a fairly new airplane that was trying to break some some records, and they were, one was a 500 kilometer, the other was a 1,000 kilometer. They finished the 500, were getting ready to go try their luck at the 1,000 kilometer record, and there was some photographer taking pictures, and he signaled to the pilot to center the rudder pedals, and the rudder didn't move, so he signaled again to center the rudder pedals, and the pilot indicated that he did. And so they shut the airplane down and went back and found out that the rudder was disconnected from the factory. It was a fairly new airplane. The airplane left the factory with the rudder not connected. And the airplane, twin engine airplane, and the airplane had been flying. So just imagine an engine failure and trying to control that airplane. So if you touch the airplane, moved it, if they had moved the rudder, they would have seen that it moved with totally zero resistance. It would have prompted some action. So you got to learn to take it, listen to your airplane, touch your airplane, you know, understand what you're looking at. You know, when you look at flight controls, you're looking at the hardware to make sure that there's cotter pins and everything you can see. Make sure everything's secured. Because when things start loosening up, they don't loosen up and fail instantly. They takes a little while usually. And so there's time for you to discover it if you know what you're looking for. So please, please do a thorough pre-flight. And when you get in the air, put your head in the swivel, because we still have a lot of rookie pilots out there. And they make mistakes, and you don't want to be part of their mistake. And at the end, please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that. And we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.